Welcome to Hollywood in Color, where I tell the stories of the stars usually left out of entertainment history, the people of color in front of and behind the camera who have been representing for over a century. I'm your host, Diana Martinez. In 1927, Warner Brothers, then a small independent movie studio, released a film called The Jazz Singer. The film, like a few others before it, featured a synchronized soundtrack. Without a live band, the audience could experience a full orchestral sound. But star Al Jolson started improvising lines as they were filming.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet. Wait a minute, I tell you. You ain't heard nothing. You want to hear Toot-Toot-Tootsie? All right, hold on.
Lou, listen. Play Toot-Toot-Tootsie. Three choruses, you understand? And the third chorus, I whistle. Now give it to him hard and heavy. Go right ahead.
Toot-Toot-Tootsie, goodbye.
Toot-Toot-Tootsie, don't cry.
The little choo-choo train,
that takes me.
The Jazz Singer wasn't the first sound film, but it was the first to use this new technology for dialogue and create a sense of realism within a fictional film. It was a huge success, earning $3.5 million worldwide, almost $42 million today. In the film, Jolson plays a performer who would rather sing jazz than be his father's successor as synagogue cantor. In the film's climax, he performs in blackface, and overcome by his talent, his mother realizes jazz is his true calling.
Mammy, the sunshine's east, the sunshine's west, but I know where the sunshine's best. Mammy.
As the first hit talking picture, The Jazz Singer didn't just set the stage for a new era of Hollywood. It established how race would be linked to this new sound technology. It anticipated the ways white Hollywood would mine black culture and later Latino culture, looking for beats, melodies, and rhymes to appropriate. Sound shored up the hierarchies of race already in place, simultaneously fetishizing and ostracizing non-white voices and accents. In the year after The Jazz Singer, Dolores Del Rio became increasingly anxious about the coming of sound. Her English wasn't very good, so she began working diligently on her accent and vocabulary, meanwhile telling the press she would never act in talkies, which was a common position. A lot of stars thought sound was just a passing fad, but they were very, very wrong. By 1929, 75% of all films had sound. In this episode, we look at Dolores' career in the 1930s, a decade that brought substantial change to Hollywood. The coming of sound limited Dolores' roles. They became more stereotypical and forgettable. She moved from studio to studio looking for opportunities like she once had. Sound amplified the difference that her light skin and Spanish señorita persona had managed to overcome. At the same time, Dolores' relationship with producer-sponsor Edwin Carew grew strained. Her marriage fell apart, she had a lot of health issues, and she experienced a loss that fundamentally changed her and her screen persona. This is episode 4 of Lupe Velez and Dolores Del Rio, Las Reinas, the Queens of Los Angeles. In January 1928, producer-director Edwin Carew made Dolores sign a contract that gave him almost complete control over her life. She agreed to make no less than 7 films with him in 3 years, and her contract could be extended beyond that if she was sick for any of that time. The contract stipulated she act, pose, and appear solely and exclusively for and as requested by Carew in the leading female roles of such photo plays as Carew may designate, and that she promptly and faithfully comply with all reasonable directions, requests, rules, and regulations made by Carew in connection herewith, and she will perform and render her services conscientiously and to the full limit of her ability, and as instructed by Carew, at all times and wherever required or desired by Carew. To Edwin, Dolores was a doll to play dress-up with, a moneymaker that could get him accepted into the ranks of Hollywood royalty. And though he was married, it didn't stop him from pressuring Dolores to take their relationship further, to give him more than her career, her persona, her look. There were rumors, probably started by Edwin, that they were having an affair. Dolores' husband Jaime was rightfully upset, and Dolores was uneasy. Her career was tied up with Edwin and their mutual lawyer Gunther Lessing, and they had done a good job. Edwin and Gunther did attempt to protect Dolores' image because they had this idea that if Dolores' people were difficult, then it would make her more desirable to studios. So that meant demanding well-paying contracts, because they earned money off of her too, and guarding her image carefully, because if she was involved in scandal, then they were out of a job. For example, Dolores' contract with the studio clearly stated that the film she made must be of high literary value, and that that value would have to be proven with a full story treatment, which was like a script outline. And the studio had to provide a proper guarantee that the finished picture will be fully in accordance with the treatment submitted. There should be no surprises. And furthermore, her contract prohibited the exploitation of her sex and body. For the most part, this tactic worked. Dolores quickly garnered a reputation for her dignified roles and modest appearance. After filming Wrapped on Ramona, Edwin became anxious. He knew he had a hit on his hands, a film that would make Dolores even bigger and would catapult him to new heights in his directorial career. But he was also worried because she was still contractually obligated to make one more film for Fox Studios, a film that he wouldn't be directing. It had always bugged Edwin that Raoul Walsh's What Price Glory had been her breakthrough role, even though Edwin had directed Dolores in 3 movies beforehand. He didn't want her working with Raoul again. In a series of tense exchanges with Fox executive Saul Wurtzel, Edwin tries desperately to find issues with the 2 projects Fox proposes. Edwin points out many flaws. The script isn't ready, the story isn't good, the story is too exploitative and sexual, and that the story lacked high class and artistic manner. To that, Wurtzel replied, "It is needless for us to say that we have no intention of producing pictures which would be other than high class in literary character." Wurtzel was, at best, annoyed, at worst, seriously regretting engaging Dolores in any more films at Fox. But he pushed on, telling Edwin that if Dolores didn't show up to the set of The Red Dance, then Edwin himself would be in breach of contract. Edwin wrote back to the studio that they weren't fulfilling their duty to him. The exchanges after that are unclear, but the results of Edwin's frantic negotiations are kind of astounding. Fox more than doubled Dolores' salary to $25,000 for 8 weeks of filming. Edwin would receive a copy from Raoul Walsh of the final script, and he got first look and editing rights to the final film. Somehow, he had gotten himself more money and a way to undermine Raoul. But Dolores saw through his manipulations. She tried to distance herself from him, which got harder the more successful she became. In February 1928, she signed a contract with United Artists, which was a dream home for actors and directors. Edwin was over the moon. At United Artists, which was a smaller, independent movie studio, he had access to huge stars. He wasn't going to let this opportunity slip. Meanwhile, as Edwin was dreaming of his future, Dolores was finishing Ramona, filming The Red Dance with Fox, and negotiating with United Artists. She was overworked, she was sick, but Edwin kept pushing. He separated from his wife, fueling even more rumors of an affair and making Dolores more uncomfortable and scared. The day Edwin's separation was announced, Hyman moved out of his and Dolores' LA home. And Dolores fell apart. Though they chose to move to Hollywood together, Dolores and Jaime's relationship changed after What Price Glory. Jaime was in her shadow. He hated being Mr. Dolores Del Rio. But they consistently denied that their marriage was on the rocks. Even when Jaime moved to New York, they maintained a united front. He told reporters, "I want to be somebody in my own name, and that is impossible out there. But my wife and I love and understand each other and will not be broken apart by busybodies. We will manage to see each other as often as possible." Dolores insisted that they would never divorce, she said. There is nothing more to be said on the subject, other than that gossip has become unbearable to us both, and that we are both keenly distressed that our domestic affairs have become public property. When Jaime left, Dolores' health issues took a turn. Her illness was attributed to a lot of things, an infection of the lungs or hives or just plain exhaustion. But, and I don't mean to be maudlin, but it was maybe also heartbreak. Though Jaime had been envious of her success, of the other men in her life, there was at one time love between them. And it probably wasn't easy to see him slipping further the happier she became. They did divorce in April 1928. Jaime said in an interview, "To the degree that a star's success increases, the importance of the spouse diminishes. He, little by little, loses all personality and is converted into a kind of ghost. Dolores, I must say, to honor the truth, did what she could on her part to preserve my self-esteem, making an effort always to give me the significance that I deserved. But the battle was lost from the beginning. I was not happy in that atmosphere, and Dolores knew it." Dolores and Jaime moved on. Dolores wrapped filming The Red Dance and went on a trip around Europe with Edwin, Gunther, and her mother. She went to parties and dinners. Jaime was supposedly dating a fancy European lady. They kept in touch. She even visited him in Berlin, where they were affectionate. Soon after Dolores returned from her European tour, she got word that Jaime was in the hospital. He had a fever. He was partially paralyzed. He was dying. It's still unclear what exactly it was. Blood poisoning was one vague term thrown around for it. Later, there were reports it was a suicide attempt. Dolores couldn't be by his side. The trip to Berlin took 3 weeks and he had days left at most. Supposedly, he asked for her, and she wrote him telegrams telling him to fight hard. With the strength he had left, he dictated a note back. tell her I'm fighting. But he didn't get better. On December 7th, 1928, Jaime died. A friend of his said, every moment of his illness, Jaime spoke of Dolores, kept muttering her name when he was unconscious, and died with her name on his lips. Years later, Dolores said, I was a widow after Jaime's death. That's the way I felt after Jaime died. Jaime hadn't been perfect, and Dolores knew this. He was controlling and insecure, and that wasn't who she thought she had married. She felt the loss deeply, but with that loss also came a sudden, strong sense of self. She didn't have to feel guilty about her success anymore. Edwin was still hovering painfully close, but having lost the most important man in her life, she was more than ready to lose this one too. She knew she would survive. The deal with United Artists was the first step to cutting ties with Edwin. Shortly after she signed the contract back before Jaime's death, the studio had taken careful steps to show their roster of talent was ready for the oncoming transition to sound. On a national radio show, Dolores sang the title song from Ramona.
I wander up yonder over the view, where the mountains climb, seem to kiss the sky. Someone is out yonder over the hill, waiting patiently, waiting just for me.
A writer for the Chicago Daily Tribune said, it is a nice treat to hear Dolores Del Rio sing and elocute a bit in broken English with a pronounced Spanish-Mexican accent, but we fear her speaking throughout a moving picture would be unintelligible and unhappy. Another reporter described Dolores' voice more favorably, if not less racistly. Dolores had a cocktail of an accent, two parts American, one part Spanish, and just a squeeze of guitar music. Her next film, Evangeline, based on a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, wasn't a full talkie. It only had songs, not dialogue. And though audiences had heard her sing in Ramona, Evangeline was different. In Ramona, Dolores played mixed race, Native American and Spanish. But in Evangeline, she played an Acadian in Nova Scotia who flees to Louisiana after forced removal by the British. At the time, Acadians were largely coded as white descendants of French colonists, though this was not always the case. But for many critics, Evangeline played with racial boundaries too much, and her accent, even while singing, made the slippage more apparent. One critic wrote, to the children of today, Evangeline will mean not the classic, if somewhat sentimental, Longfellow muse, but Dolores del Rio, classic in her beauty, certainly, but as far from Nordic as Salem is from Mexico City. Her debut in the motion picture version of What Price Glory established her immediately as one of the most glamorous figures on the screen. Subsequently, in Resurrection, she proved that she was also an actress of tragic intensity. But now she is embarking on a very different role, and a hazardous one, for Evangeline is an American tradition. The transition to sound film was difficult for a lot of stars, foreign or not. A good silent film actor was over-expressive and dramatic, but talkies required actors to emote through dialogue. The pressure to have a clear, strong voice forced a lot of silent film greats into early retirement. But for foreign actors, discussions of voice and accent were wrapped up in questions of nationalism. In December 1931, Screenland magazine ran an article that shows growing concerns about the popularity of foreign stars and their competition with American actresses. Titled Domestic versus Foreign Charmers, the author writes, Dietrich soared to glory with a voice not unlike Garbo's, with exactly the right throaty piquancy, and foreign accent stock soared. The doors were wide open. Even nice, sweet American girls started acquiring accents. Accents became a way to discuss other essential differences between Americans and non-Americans. The coming of sound collided with the Great Depression, which stirred an increased preoccupation with defining Americanness. The article states, another thing about these foreign girls, they always give an impression of being grown up, comfortably mature. Dolores Del Rio at 20 won us in the film Redemption. Somehow we cannot imagine an American girl giving us such a performance, at least until she is nearing 30. Many fan magazines had always taken a hard stance against the flapper, the youthful girl about town of the 1920s. There was a growing preference for chaste femininity and natural beauty. And sedate foreigners were an antidote to the new woman. Many thought actresses like Greta Garbo and Anna Mae Wong had a certain gravitas the medium needed to be taken seriously. They were usually typecast as villains or fallen women, so it was easy to see how this was conflated with their personalities as being more mature and dark. But the article goes on. Then too, with a few precious American exceptions, these foreigners seem so cultivated, so particularly well-informed. They speak several languages. All the Spanish actors and actresses who are making good in English versions speak beautiful, cultured English, far better than our native quality. In the early years of sound film, there wasn't a consensus on what America should sound like. British-inflected English was preferred for a while because it more closely resembled the accents of renowned stage actors. But this was soon abandoned because it just didn't fit with some stars. And the article also indicates an insecurity about education, a hint that foreign actors have an advantage over Americans because of their worldliness, because of their abilities to cross national boundaries, to speak to Americans and Germans, Poles, Mexicans, and whoever. The very instability of their nationality, which, as the decade went on, became more tied to ethnic and racial identity, was fascinating and threatening. Dolores told a magazine, "If I can't do it, if the talkies defeat me, I shall try the stage." Dolores' first all-talkie was the 1930 film The Bad One. It was also her first film outside Edwin's management. In October 1929, United Artists president Joseph Schenck decided he had had enough of Edwin's manipulation. He bought out Dolores' contract for $500,000. Dolores said in an interview, "I find that I am born again. I have never been myself, never in my life. I have never been free. I have never been happy. I have bowed to conditions, circumstances, to the dictates of other people. I have been suppressed and repressed all my life. Repressed in my work, repressed in my personal life. I am not by nature melancholy, weepy, sorrowful, languishing, sweet. I am not patient. I am not conventional. I am not a Ramona or an Evangeline. More, I am the girl of what price glory. There, for a bit, I could show my real self. I am, by nature, tempestuous, fiery, stormy, eager. I have never had a chance to express the sex that is in me. I am going to begin now. I am going to be free. In The Bad One, Dolores plays Lita, a Spanish singer working in a French brothel. The film was stereotypical and wasn't well received. And once again, Dolores had a string of terrible events that made working really difficult. Edwin was angry that she had broken their contract and she paid him $100,000 to placate him. Dolores had also fired Gunther Lessing, knowing that his loyalties lay with Edwin. Gunther sued her for more money, but he didn't just keep his arguments to that. He claimed she had encouraged his wife to divorce him, that she had spoken badly of him. If it was true, he had deserved it. But the court ordered Dolores to pay him $16,000 for services rendered. She was hemorrhaging money, and the stress of these legal troubles made her illnesses worse. She was committed to do a remake of The Dove, but her health and all this scandal got in the way. United Artists canceled her contract in 1931. You might remember The Dove. It was the film that Lupe was supposed to make when she arrived in Hollywood, but she lost out on the lead role for being too young. The role eventually went to white actress Norma Talmadge, which was just as well. The film was reviled by Mexican audiences who had become increasingly aware of the terrible stereotypes of Mexican people perpetuated in Hollywood films. Norma played a Mexican saloon singer whose life is made difficult by the town dictator when she begins dating a white man. They are both falsely imprisoned and sentenced to death. It seemed at first that Dolores had escaped this film, which she was sure to have had at least a passing knowledge of. But when she signed a contract at RKO Studios, The Dove came with her, except it was given a new title in order to disassociate it with its offensive source material. The film was renamed The Girl of the Rio. The Mexican audiences, who had so far loved her dearly for her dignified representation in Hollywood, thought she was a sellout. Dolores spoke with an exaggerated accent, and the film's humor centered on making fun of her and the other Mexican characters. The Girl of the Rio portrayed Mexico as a corrupt place where the judicial system meant nothing. The film was banned in Mexico City the day after its premiere. Dolores needed a hit. It had been a while since she had lived up to her name. Bird of Paradise was her big Hollywood comeback. The film was directed by the renowned King Vidor, who was known for his realism, lush sets, and stunning cinematography. He didn't even really have a story for Bird of Paradise in mind, but he knew he wanted three hot love scenes between Dolores and his male lead, Joel McRae. By 1932, the production code was already in place, though it wasn't enforced consistently. The production code was a self-censorship code that the studios adopted that outlined certain don'ts and be carefuls. No profanity, no drugs, no scenes of childbirth, no sympathy for criminals, no rape, no woman selling her virtue, and so on. Directors got very creative at pushing the boundaries of the code. For Birds of Paradise, King Vidor was banking on the film's salacious material to grab audiences, and he didn't hesitate in using sex to sell. Dolores was ready. It was what she had wanted for a while, to be seen as exciting and seductive. Dolores played the lead role of Luana, a Polynesian princess in a torrid love affair with a white man. Before shooting even began, the studio tipped the press that Dolores was so scantily clad in this next role that she was sunbathing nude in her garden to tan her skin. Her final costume was a long grass skirt and two strategically placed leis that barely covered her breasts. It was said that airplanes frequently flew above and very low to Dolores' Hollywood Hills house, trying to catch a glimpse of her. Birds of Paradise was marketed as a new kind of role for Dolores, a break from her type that audiences just couldn't miss. One article wrote, "Would you believe that the wild hula dancer, gone as native as a grass skirt, is smart Dolores Del Rio, one of the most sedate and ladylike social leaders of the film colony?" One of the features of the production code was its anti-miscegenation clause. So-called race mixing wasn't allowed. But King Vidor, who had experience working with casts of color, knew that this clause only specifically prohibited the interracial relationships between white and black characters. Dolores was in some space in between. She was Mexican, but sold as Spanish and playing a Polynesian woman. Furthermore, there was an implied understanding that interracial romance was fine. In fact, many movies centered on the forbidden sexual desire between races. But miscegenation was defined as altogether a different thing. Two characters of different races could have a romance as long as that romance didn't lead to children, as long as that romance served as a lesson against interbreeding. Birds of Paradise then got away with having plenty of sex, well, implied sex. There's a pretty saucy skinny dipping scene that got cut from the American version of the film. Also a scene where Luana dances sexily for Johnny, her lover. But in the climax of the movie comes maybe the most objectionable scene. Johnny is wounded and needs water. Luana grabs a piece of fruit, extracts the juice with her mouth, and feeds it to him in long, deep, sticky kisses. Birds of Paradise pushed at the limits of the miscegenation clause, but ultimately, like other Hollywood films, stood against the coupling of the woman of color and white man. In the film, Luana is about to go back to America with Johnny, but her father threatens to kill him. In the end, she sacrifices herself to save Johnny from her father. Luana throws herself into a volcano, paying the ultimate price for ignoring the unspoken laws that forbid her from touching any man outside her tribe. The film posits miscegenation as a universal taboo, one upheld even by Luana's tribe. And though the movie acknowledges the natural attraction between Luana and Johnny, it portrays their pending marriage and the eventual consummation of that marriage as morally corrupt. Birds of Paradise was a hit, and Dolores' accent wasn't a barrier at all. She didn't speak English in the film, instead adopting a kind of gibberish that she passed off as a Polynesian language. But the role of Luana, though a kind of break from the morose women she usually played, served to further exoticize her. Though Dolores was ready to show her newfound sexual freedom after breaking with Edwin and losing Jaime, she chose the wrong time to do it. Following the Great Depression, America became more conservative about sex and women's roles. The new woman was gone, just when Dolores had become one. Dolores made a lot of films after Birds of Paradise, like the 1933 Flying Down to Rio. As she continued to be celebrated for her exotic looks, she was rejected for lead roles. In an interview, she said, By the mid-1930s, there was a new set of fresh faces, and the really plum roles were going to actresses like Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn or Barbara Stanwyck, meaning they were going to white women who used language as a weapon, deploying sexual innuendo and American slang in their films. In the next and final episode of the season, we pick up Dolores and Lupe's careers at the end of the 1930s, when Lupe cements her legacy with the Mexican Spitfire series, and Dolores returns to Mexico to start a new chapter in her life away from Hollywood. This episode of Hollywood in Color has been produced, edited, and narrated by me, Diana Martinez. All artwork for the show was designed by Shelby Mooring. Every episode of this podcast is heavily researched. If you want info on the books, articles, and sources I used, check out the show notes. There, you'll also find info about the theme song and other music used in this episode. If you liked this episode and want to keep up with what's next, follow the show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at HWoodInColor. And with that said, I can't wait to tell you another chapter of our story next week.